Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. 50 years ago, a serial killer prowled the quiet city of London, Ontario, marking it as his hunting grounds. As young women and boys were abducted, raped, and murdered, residents of the area held their loved ones closer and closer, terrified of the monster or monsters stalking the streets. Homicide detective Dennis Alsup began hunting the killer in the 1960s, and he didn't stop searching until his death 40 years later. For decades, detectives, actual and armchair, and the victims' families and friends continued to ask questions. Who was the Forest City killer? Was there more than one person, or did a depraved individual commit all of these crimes on his own? Combing through the files Detective Alsup left behind, researcher Vanessa Brown reopens the cases, revealing previously unpublished witness statements, details of evidence, and astonishing revelations. And through her investigation, Vanessa posits the unthinkable. Is it possible that the Forest City Killer is still alive and, like the notorious Golden State Killer, a simple DNA test could bring him to justice? The book that we're featuring this evening is The Forest City Killer, a serial murderer, a cold case sleuth, and a search for justice, with my special guest, researcher and author, Vanessa Brown. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Vanessa Brown.
Hi, Dan. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much for joining me with this incredible book, The Forest City Killer. Tell our audience a little bit about, before we start, about your occupation and your background and your interest in all things London. Tell us a little bit about your background before we talk about your fateful meeting with Dennis Alsup, Jr.
Sure. My day job is at a bookstore. I own, with my husband, an antiquarian bookstore in downtown London. So an antiquarian bookstore, in addition to having general used books for people to enjoy and read, we also sell specialize in rare books, so first editions, signed editions, hard-to-find limited print paper matter, old letters, ephemera, and all sorts of interesting things, anything printed on paper. So that's my day job, and that means I work a lot in researching history and the importance of sort of cultural artifacts that come under my nose. And I also work a lot with libraries and archives. We really help members of the public who might have something special, something unique or interesting that should be kept in an archive. We help them get in touch with those librarians and archivists. And we also find things ourselves sometimes when we're out hunting for material. So, you know, I've developed an understanding, I think, more than the average person about how libraries and archives work and the kind of resources that are available for members of the public to access when it comes to doing research. But I'm also a lifelong Londoner. I've lived here my entire life, and, you know, it's a community that I love. So my previous two books are about London, Ontario, and its history. I wrote a book about a historic hotel that's no longer here. And my husband and I wrote a book about 150 cultural moments in London's history. So in addition to being an antiquarian bookseller, I think I'm a bit of a local history buff. I like to know what's happened in my city, and I like the unusual aspects of my city's history. So, you know, you can look in any history book about London to find out about its founding and important businesses and schools and churches and all of those things. But to me, the really interesting stories are the oddball ones that are harder to find and that really tell the story about how our city became the unique place that it is.
You write about a book you discovered in 2015 from Michael Arnfield, a book called Murder City. What does he suggest in that book? And you talk about the anomaly that was, that he refers to, he suggests about London. Tell us about the population of London, a little bit about its access to Toronto and Detroit, and tell us about Michael Arnfield's book and his suggestion.
Sure. Mike Arnfield is a professor up at Western University, and in 2015, he released a book called Murder City about London, Ontario, and the anomalous number of serial killers that were here, mainly in the 1960s and 1970s. He purported that London, Ontario is the serial killer capital of Canada, if not the world. Now, I can't speak to that thesis. I'm not a criminologist or a sociologist, but it immediately grabbed my attention. And I met with Mike. I interviewed him. I reviewed his book for a local publication, and I was sort of hooked on the subject matter. In Mike's book, one of the things he talks about is London's unique makeup as a silo city. So you have these sort of independent silo communities where people are very self-referential, but it creates these little pockets of independence, and it's very good for test markets. So London's been known as a test market city, and I like to say we were the test market for Chicken McNuggets, for Tim Horton's dark roast coffee, and unfortunately, we were a test market for serial killers. London is located, of course, equidistant between Detroit and Toronto along a superhighway, like an interstate. So it's a very easy city to come in and get out of quickly if you need to. It's sort of a WASPy conservative place. And in 1968, when the spate of murders, the main section of murders in my book starts, the city had a population of about 160,000 people. And of course, that included some annexed rural territory around the city that had been annexed the year before. So that's actually an elevated number. The population was probably something more like 140 or 130,000 in the city proper. So it's not a big place. And in 2 years, we have 9 unsolved homicides, sexual homicides related to women and children. And that's the focus of my book.
Now, you write that when you were reading Michael Arnfield's book, Murder City, that you read in particular about the Jackie English case. And you said that despite being a local history buff, you didn't know about a lot of these unsolved cases. They really did. You weren't aware whatsoever. And reading about Jackie English's case and your research, you found Dennis Alsup Jr. Tell us about this fateful meeting between you both and how it came that you met. What were you looking at online?
Yes. I was looking at this incredible website called unsolvedcanada.ca, which is unfortunately no longer working. And that's very disappointing because it was an incredible treasure trove of information, kind of like Canadian web sleuths. Even more so, there were, family members, victims' family members, and community members really working hard together and bringing all their skills to the table to try and solve these crimes on their own. People going into the archives and paying for reproductions of photos, maps. There were people doing, pseudoscientific testing on car paint in different lights, historic car paint colors, and, water testing and all sorts of, it's really very impressive what this community of people were doing. Wow. So when I read Murder City, I found that website, of course, just Googling the cases, and that was impressive. But of course, Mike wrote about Dennis Jr. in his book. And I guess I should tell you who Dennis is. Dennis Alsop Sr. was the lead investigator on the Jackie English murder and the other murders that took place that are unsolved and solved ones as well, but mainly the unsolved cases. And he died in 2012. And when his son was going through his things, he found three banker's boxes filled with notes and files from his father's time as a homicide investigator for the Ontario Provincial Police, which is sort of like our state police, I guess, for your American listeners. And Dennis had looked through all of these, and he realized that there were answers for the family members in those files. People who didn't know what had happened to their loved ones and didn't realize that, you know, there was more information, I think, that they were given. So, you know, Dennis felt this responsibility to carry on his father's legacy. And the Jackie English case in particular was one that he had continued to work on until his death. So
you write
Dennis Jr. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Dennis Jr. had wanted to reach out to the families, but that's a very sort of tedious, not tedious, a challenging task. You want to make sure that you don't offend people or bring up terrible memories for them or hurt them in any way. Right. Some people don't want to talk about those kinds of tragedies, you know? Mm-hmm. So Dennis had been reading the newspaper, and he read about the Walk for Jackie. The Walk for Jackie takes place every year, and Jackie English is one of the murder victims, the main focus of my book. And her surviving sister, Anne English, remembers her sister annually. She goes to the same place where her sister disappeared on the same date at the same time, and she rewalks what she calls her sister's last steps of freedom every year. And this was covered in the newspaper, and when Dennis Jr. read the article, he thought, this is a good opportunity to reach out, because he could reach out through the newspaper reporter. So there was sort of a natural buffer there. And if Anne didn't want to talk to him, she didn't have to, but she did, of course. She wanted to know all the information Dennis had, and this connected them. And that meeting really was a catalyst for all of the citizen sleuths and community members who have been working to find resolution to these cases, because it really opened up the door for any victims' families who wanted to find out more to be able to talk to Dennis and see what his father had left behind.
Right. Now, Dennis was an identification officer and special training in fingerprints, so he's especially valuable to the police. You talk about October 1969 and Jackie English. You open this book with this scene where Detective Alsup becomes involved, and he just gets a call. Of course, he's doing something else, but he has to rush to this crime scene. Tell us about Jackie English, a little bit about her background, before we talk about her disappearance and then the investigation.
Yeah, Jackie was a 15-year-old girl. She was born that April 17th, was her birthday. And she came from an interesting family. She had a single mom, and she lived with her mom and her brother. Her older sister had moved away, actually, to live with her fiancé in Hamilton, where her dad actually was in the hospital for cancer. So their family was sort of spread apart a little bit, but, you know, Jackie had a home with her mom and her brother, and they were a working class family. They had jobs. They all worked and contributed to the household. So Jackie got a job at the Latin Quarter restaurant, which was a fancy restaurant in downtown London. And she got that job through her mom, and they worked there together. And Jackie really enjoyed making money. So, you know, the summer when she was 15, she sort of made this decision that she was going to probably drop out of school and start working, which her mom did not approve of her dropping out of school, actually. She didn't tell her mom that she hadn't gone back to school, but she got a second job. And the second job was at this sort of discount mall in a plaza way out in the south end of the city. And, of course, the posh restaurant she worked at with her mom was right downtown, like near their house. And this one was way out by the highway. So you actually had to cross over the overpass to get to the restaurant. And it was like a discount department store and it had a restaurant in it, like a diner, and she worked at the diner at the counter serving customers as a waitress. So that was Jackie. And, you know, she kept a diary, and I was able to read that diary and sort of get to know her as a person. And she really was like a fun loving, incredible 15-year-old girl. And, you know, I think in a lot of true crime, it's very easy to go back and sort of venerate the victims, you know, like she was a perfect angel and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that about Jackie. I don't think she was a perfect angel, but I think she was a very relatable, smart, fun woman, young woman. And she, I think she would have been an awesome adult woman to know. She was no nonsense. She came from like a no nonsense family. She liked really colorful clothes. She wore taboo perfume, which if anyone knows about perfumes, it's no Chanel No. 5. It's a distinctive scent. She was a strong personality, but also a very generous person. And she was raised with the values of giving, you know, basically giving her paycheck to her family. So, you know, they all worked together. And there was this sort of a survival aspect to that, which I really admire. So that was Jackie. She had, I guess, related to the case, you know, this was her first summer exploring, you know, being a little bit boy crazy, you know, noticing that older guys were looking at her. She was developing into, you know, a pretty attractive young lady, and she noticed that she got the attention she wanted. And she wasn't promiscuous. She wasn't living anything I would call a high-risk lifestyle at all. She wasn't a party animal. But she was, you know, doing the normal 15-year-old things for 1969, for sure.
How is it that she goes missing and then immediately police look at people surrounding her and she has a boyfriend, then another interest at work? There's a search. Tell us about her disappearance, the search, what happens? What's everyone's reaction?
Oh, people were worried right away. I mean, Jackie was very independent, but she was also very reliable. Like she held down two jobs well. She was mature beyond her years because of the life that she had led, and mature in a good way. So when she didn't show up for her shift and she wasn't at home, people knew something was wrong immediately. So her mother checked her out of the hospital and in fact checked herself out of the hospital. That was something I need to rewind here. When Jackie went missing after work, she usually got a ride home with her mom from her job at the Metropolitan, which it was, as I say, way on the edge of town. Like you could catch a bus, but it came like once an hour and it was probably a 20-minute walk from the restaurant. So, you know, that night on October 4th, 1969, Jackie left her shift at 10 p.m. Usually she would walk over to an industrial building called Northern Electric where her mom worked, and her mom would get off an hour after her and she would get a ride downtown again with her mom. But her mom was in the hospital that week having a minor surgery, like a routine surgery. Of course, back in the 60s, there weren't these in-and-out surgeries. You stayed for a week. So Jackie didn't have a ride home, and she didn't ask for a ride. She started to walk over the overpass towards the bus stop. So presumably she was going to catch the bus, but a car pulled up next to her. And there are several eyewitness accounts of seeing her get into the car. There was no struggle. She didn't have her thumb out. So she wasn't sort of generally hitching a ride. So the idea is that it's probably someone she recognized, got into the car, and then she disappeared. So, you know, the next day, the restaurant staff at the Latin Quarter were expecting her to show up for work. And when she didn't show up, they actually used some of their connections with the police who were customers at the restaurant to start getting the investigation going. And the family got together and they all sort of congregated in the apartment building where they lived, and there was no official police search for Jackie. They didn't comb fields, they didn't go out with a search dog. It was really just family and friends following up on any lead that they got to see if they could find her.
There is a diary found and by her mother, Doris. What clues, if any, are in that diary? And we talked about how police didn't conduct a search, and that is consistent in a lot of these cases in this book that you chronicle. But also that the idea that this boyfriend, who was known to be boyfriend David Papel, that she had said that she had a love for David, she developed a love for David, that he would be involved with the family in a search while there was no official police search. But tell us what, if any, clues were found in that diary.
Yeah, they searched her room, sort of hoping to get some tidbits about where she might be. And they did find her diary. And inside the diary, the first thing they noticed was that there were entries written in code. And they were hoping that those coded entries would help them. And so sometimes, you know, if you hear about this case, some people get very excited that there is a secret code in the diary. But unfortunately, it's not that compelling. There are two other compelling clues in the diary. The code was really just about her kissing boys. It does tell us, though, a lot about her as a person. If, you know, she was doing anything more illicit or risky, you would expect her to have recorded that in her diary in that code. And she didn't. The most risky things Jassy wrote about really were kissing boys. So, you know, she was still a rather naive and innocent young girl in many ways. But in the diary, there are two clues that are still unresolved. The first is a picture of a young man that is unidentified. The picture has a dark-haired young man sitting on steps of some sort of building, like a early 20th century, late 19th century looking sort of Romanesque architecture building, smiling. The snapshot had a name written on the back, and the name is Ricardo Fropo. Of course, I can't find a record of any Ricardo Fropo ever existing, so I think that name is pretty made up. The other clue is a phone number in the back. There were actually two phone numbers. The first one was scratched out as if it was an error. And using reverse telephone search in the archives, I was able to find out that number doesn't exist from that time period in this area code, so it probably really was an error. The phone number that is there, I did find. In the diary, there's no name with the phone number. Instead, there is, again, sort of a code. But if you run it through her diary code, it doesn't give any answers at all. The code is LLL401KE. The 401 is interesting because, of course, that's the highway, but that went through town, but I can't figure out the rest. And there is this phone number. I contacted the people who had the phone number during that time. Significantly, Jackie had gotten this diary for her birthday the previous April, so she only had it for 6 months. That phone number then had to be concurrent with who had that number during that 6 month period. It's not like she wrote it in there 5 years earlier and the number changed hands.
Right.
When I spoke to the woman whose number it was, she was just shocked that a murder victim had her phone number in there. And she and her husband only lived in London, Ontario for a very short period of time, about 18 months. But interestingly, she did tell me that, she was doing her master's at the University of Toronto, which is 2 hours away, and she was only home on the weekends. So, you know, I haven't been able to account for her husband's whereabouts during the week in that time period. So I think that's an interesting lead that I'd want law enforcement to take up.
Very interesting. You also talk about a horrible scene in that this Agnes Murray had to ID the body and then the police, insensitive at the time, said, listen, she wasn't a virgin. She couldn't even she couldn't even recognize her without that police officer that person showing them her birthmark. And then you talk about Doris' suicide attempt, and where does she end up for a year after this?
In the London Psychiatric Hospital, yeah. So she's left her son, who's 14, and her older daughter, who's 16. They have their single mom is in the psych hospital, and their father is in Hamilton in the hospital dying of cancer. So these two kids have no one. they're just on their own. And then, of course, they have to work to pay the bills. There's no financial help from them at all from the government. And heartbreakingly, her little brother got a job at the same posh restaurant that she'd worked at, washing dishes to help raise money to pay for a gravestone for her. So, I mean, the whole story is just agonizing.
Yeah. And then you have a scene where Detective Alsop, involved in this, first involved in this investigation, is at that funeral. And as police understood, at least at that time, it might be a good idea to observe the funeral in case, to see who might come and people's behavior. Now, the next case that you talk about is Jacqueline Dunleavy. And first tell us who her father is, and then you open with three boys, this one deaf-mute named Wayne Heblethwaite. He got a car. He was able to drive, even though despite his disability, and he was going cruising with his friends. Tell us who Jacqueline Dunleavy is. How old is she? Tell us about her father, and then tell us about Wayne and his buddies, what they discover one night driving.
Yeah, Jacqueline Dunleavy was 16, I believe, and forgive me if I'm getting that wrong. She may have been 15. I don't have it in front of me. Jacqueline was a high school student who had a part-time job after school at a variety store in downtown London. Her father was a constable with the London Police. He was actually the head of the union. So, you know, he was a well-loved, well-recognized member of the London Police Force. And they lived in the west end of the city. But Jacqueline went to high school in the west end, but she had this part-time job at a variety store sort of downtown. So she'd go there after school and work a 3-hour shift twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So it was on one of those Thursdays on January 9th, 1968, she left work and it was cold. It was January in Canada and she was supposed to head to the bus stop to go home. But of course she never came home. And she had gotten into a vehicle. There was someone who reported that they saw her get into a vehicle.
How was she found? What was the condition on when she was found? And we haven't mentioned Jackie English's condition, but we will just talk about how she was found, how Dunleavy was found.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked me about that, because to me, that's one of the more fascinating stories in the book. And this is exactly the type of local history that really captivates my imagination, how people come together in these strange situations. There was, to start with, Wayne Heblethwaite, who was deaf, and he had been in the foster care system. And he'd had a rough life, but he'd finally landed on his feet with this great foster family who had their own biological daughter was deaf as well. And, you know, Wayne was 19, and he'd just gotten this car. He hadn't even gotten the ownership papers yet. He'd gotten this car that was outfitted so that a deaf person could drive. And he was really excited about it. So he got permission from his parents to go out on a school night. And he went and picked up two of his friends that he'd known when he was in an earlier stage of sort of the child welfare system, living in a group home. So he picked up these two guys and they were going out cruising. I mean, they were teenagers. The two younger boys were 14 and Wayne was 19. So there's an age disparity there. But because of the child welfare system that they were a part of, they would have gone for assessments or treatments out at the Children's Psychiatric Research Institute on the west end of London. So this was a location they knew of, and it was a place where they could go to sort of, they knew this was a spot they could be alone, maybe smoke a joint, maybe have a beer, or even just like smoke cigarettes and not getting shit from their parents. So they drove out there in Wayne's new car for what was supposed to be a really fun night. And then they pulled into the driveway of one of the schools there. It was a Catherine Harley School. for unfortunately named their retrainable retarded children. And they pulled into the school parking lot, and that's where they found the body of Jacqueline Dunleavy.
Now, what was the, again, what was the condition? What are the, some of the things that they found initially just with that discovery of her body?
Well, I mean, the three boys took off right away, and they fortunately found an officer in a cruiser who came to the scene. And that officer I interviewed, and he stayed at the scene. They had this, it's an archaic system, I'll admit, but their system was for the officer who was first on the scene to stay with the body all the way through for chain of evidence. And he was
right
to write his name on the victim's hand in ballpoint pen. So he was there through the entire thing. And he had known Jacqueline Dunleavy personally because she babysat
wow
for him. And her body was so badly battered in the face that he did not recognize her and did not realize it was her until they found her wallet. She had been strangled with her own scarf. She'd been beaten badly around the left side of her face. So if she was the passenger in a vehicle, that would make sense.
Right.
Her shirt was torn open, exposing her breasts. Her skirt was hiked up, exposing her vaginal area. And the contents of her backpack, like of her bag, were sort of strewn about. And there was semen on her coat, and I believe there was some semen in her mouth. But what's very interesting is that in her mouth was stuffed a package, like a travel pack, of pink
right
facial tissue.
Yeah.
Which, of course, means that I don't ever want to have a package of facial tissue around me ever again.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Interestingly, too, the boys were taken to the police station, and Wayne, horrifyingly, didn't know what was going on, was very confused, very scared, and his foster parents were not notified. Again, this just added to the dismay of everyone, but the parents were relieved when they saw him at 5 in the morning he came home. But in this investigation, what's, again, a very heavy scene in your book, is that this police officer, John Dunleavy, has to go down and ID his daughter's body. And
mm-hmm
you write about that.
Yeah. The officer who had stayed with her body throughout was also at the morgue when John came in, and he said that he just was completely broken. Just completely
yeah
broken. And you can imagine being a constable, your job is to protect the public.
Yeah.
And here is your own daughter. And I honestly, Dan, I can't think of anything worse than losing a child in a random serial homicide. I mean, these are predators, and it's the most terrifying thing to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, with Detective Alsup, interestingly, Dunleavy's murder was not in his jurisdiction, but he wanted to read the files. And you write, it reminded mm-hmm him of a case he investigated 2 years earlier in Elmer. So we'll be talking about
that's
that
right
soon. We'll be talking about that soon.
Yeah.
So now, shortly after this, again, I'm skipping over these leads that the police have to contend with, but you also have the issue that you talk about, and we might as well talk about it now, that there was an issue, as people know that have watched any kind of police procedurals on TV, fiction and nonfiction, there's jurisdiction problems. Now, there's London police and then the Ontario Provincial Police. Explain the differences in the forces and any tension there might be in the jurisdictions as these cases escalate and the pressure from the community escalates as well.
Sure. I think from a geographical standpoint, you know, it's like there's a city and then you have your city police and then you have your sheriff's department. It's
right
sort of similar to that relationship. So in London, Ontario, London proper, you have a London police force and their job is to take care of anything that happens within the city. And then the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police, they take care of the rural communities surrounding and any small towns or villages that don't have their own independent police force. But of course, what was happening with these murders consistently is that, with the exception of the Dunleavy case, is that the individual is taken from the London area and their body is disposed of in Ontario Provincial Police jurisdiction. So wherever the body is found, that's the force that's in charge of the case. So you have these Ontario police who, they're not just in charge of the rural area, they're also sort of called in for special crimes, like major crimes, sort of like how you'd call in the FBI. That's the OPP does that too. So for the independent police in London, having the OPP come in, it's sort of like your big brother is showing up at your party and all your friends think your big brother's really cool. And you're like, yeah, get out of my birthday party because you're ruining it. I want the attention. So there's that struggle between the two jurisdictions. I do know of instances where information was just straight up not passed between the two bodies. And, you know, it's not just because of, you know, computer systems and databases. There are people who did investigations in London that should have shared that information. So, you know, Detective Alsop is having to navigate those relationships while at the same time just trying to find out who's killing these children.
Now, you write about a serial killer expert, and I think it's important to talk about this now as we proceed into other victims and other ages. Well, not saying necessarily other races, but there is a biracial victim. Let's talk about Dr. Mike Ahmad, who runs a serial killer database at Radford University. He talks about the common misperception about serial killers. What is that common misperception regarding?
Well, the misperception is that serial killers only kill the same type of victim every time. And I think a lot of that public perception comes from Ted Bundy, you know, or David Berkowitz, like women changing their haircuts so they don't match the profile so the serial killer won't pick them up. So there's this perception that, you know, a serial killer will only kill teenage girls, or they'll only kill children, or they'll only kill old women, like the Boston Strangler, or that sort of thing. Not that the Boston Strangler only killed old women, but you know what I'm saying. And what Dr. Ahmad is saying is that that's not correct. The serial killers often cross lines of gender, cross lines of race, cross lines of age, that there are so many factors that come into play. So victimology can be deceptive. It can seem like, oh, this is a separate set of cases. But if you have those blinders on, you can miss other connections that might tell you, no, this is the same person. This individual is killing men and women, you know, children and teenagers, black people, white people, indigenous people. It doesn't have to be so black and white. That's the misperception.
Right. Now that leads us to February 9th, 1968, and a victim of 9 years old, Frankie Jensen. And you write that since the Jacqueline Dunleavy's murder, parents asked their kids, obviously, you know, to stay together. But tell us what Frankie does on his way to school. And again, how do they find his body? What's the condition? And what is the similarity with the Dunleavy case? Remarkably.
Yes. Yeah. So Frankie actually lived in the same neighborhood as Jackie. And he was taken exactly a month later to the day. So Frankie was on his way to school, and there was this group of school kids that were walking together to be safe. But Frankie had gone home sick from school the day before, and he was late coming out of his house that morning. So when he didn't come out on time, the group of school kids sort of thought he wasn't coming. So they went on ahead of him. But in fact, Frankie had a problem with his winter coat, because again, it's February in Canada. And by the time he figured out that situation and got out the door, the group of kids was far ahead of him. So he was isolated, unpredictably so, So that does tell you something about the killer, that they have to be regularly hunting, looking for that opportunity. So Frankie walked to school, and in fact, he got pretty close to the school, but the bell rang, and some of his friends saw him on his way, but they all went inside the building, and he never made it into the building. So they found his body in early spring, shortly thereafter. I believe it's about 6 weeks afterwards.
Right.
And he was, again, outside of London. Now, in this situation, he's not, he's like Jackie English in a body of water. So he's in the Thames River, and they recovered him. It's interesting because a week before they found his body in the water, there was actually a canoe race that went right by his body. And in fact, the farmer who found him had been at that part of the river watching the canoes go by, and he thought he saw something in the water, but he wasn't sure what it was. And it was about a week. Oh, it was, the farmer didn't find his body. I'm sorry. It was on his property. But a week later, another pair of canoers were going up that same route when they found Frankie in the water. And he was partially clothed. Of course, his pants were removed. And in his mouth was a wad of pink facial tissue.
Right. You know, and despite this, you in the press at that time, the London police force said they didn't think the killings of Frankie Jensen and Jacqueline Dunleavy were connected. And even though the bodies were found so close to each other. Now, despite that, you talk about Scott Leishman. Tell us a little bit about particulars of the Scott Leishman disappearance.
Yeah, so actually, just before they found Frankie's body, but, you know, on the same, I mean, the same concession, I mean, like hundreds of yards away from where they would find Frankie's body, another boy is picked up, Scott Leishman. He gets into a car willingly, taking a ride on March break after a fishing trip with some friends, and then his body is found later that spring, closer to summer, in a body of water. The same body of water, by the way, that Jackie English was found in, just in a different section of that body of water, in the harbor of Port Burwell in southwestern Ontario. So you have Jackie Dunleavy, whose body is found close to where she lived and close to where Frankie Jensen lived. Frankie's taken from that same spot and then found out, it is actually in the country in Thorndale, about 20 minutes outside of London. He's found in the river, and then right where Frankie was found, another boy is taken, and he's found in the water that connects to Jackie English's murder. So, you know, these, from a geographical standpoint, it's bizarre. And the pink tissue in the mouth is also an important point. Mike Arnfield talks about how the press had revealed that Jackie Dunleavy had this pink tissue in her mouth, and so that whoever killed Frankie Jensen was probably a copycat. That's possible. However,
wow.
I do think we can't ignore that he's coming from the same neighborhood, and it's a month to the day. And, you know, if you're talking about an opportunistic sexual predator who sees that in the newspaper and says, oh, if I commit a murder now and I put pink tissue in their mouth, they'll think it's this guy and it'll throw them off the scent. Okay. But what are the chances that that person also says, I'm going to pick a kid from the same neighborhood. I'm going to do it a month to the day. You know, it's a little too much of a coincidence for me. And the two cases are related regardless, whether one's influenced the other and it's two different killers or if it is the same killer. I think there's definitely a relationship there that can't be ignored. And of course, Scott Leishman is, to me, clearly picked up when a killer is revisiting the scene and revisiting Frankie's body. I mean, that's just too bizarre a coincidence. I mean, he lived across the street from the river where Frankie was found. So it's just implausible to me that it's not the same killer.
And you write, too, that police were not aware of connections and ideas that killers would, till they had Bundy and that they had spoke to him and others like him, They had no idea that people would go back to a disposal site and then revisit the corpses or anything like that. They didn't assume those things when they looked at a crime scene or the connection between crime scenes, did they?
No, I mean, they had the idea that criminals return to the scene of the crime, that old maxim. That's why they're checking all the license plates at the funeral, right? Because
right.
they figure the killer is going to be curious and want to see what's going on. But I think the idea was the killer is keeping track to make sure they don't get caught. Not that the killer has some sort of erotic sexual arousal from looking at the corpse or some sort of other excitement that comes from looking at the corpse, which, yeah, that comes into play much later. Keeping in mind that this is 1968, so that you're just starting to have the Zodiac is the next year, the Manson family murders are the next year. So public awareness and understanding, we want to think that the cops are 10 years ahead of us in our understanding of criminal behavior, but that's not always the case. And, you know, just to quickly speak to it, in 1968 in London, Ontario, police were required to have a grade 10 education. There was no one trained in homicide. There was no forensic pathologist. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about essentially glorified bouncers. And if you do have someone with a higher skill level who's going to be looking at serial bank robbers or fraudsters, they're going to be at the OPP level, and they are also a very small handful of identification officers like Dennis Alsop, who fortunately was local and was working on these cases. But he was maybe, you know, five or six other officers in the entire province who had that skill set. So there's no awareness of the word serial killer doesn't exist, but there's no awareness of this sort of pathological behavior. And if there is, it's very limited to a select group of individuals and certainly not to anyone on the London police force.
Now, you include shortly after this another attack, again, completely different victimology. August 5th, 1968, Helga Beer, she's 31 years old and she's a wig stylist, and she's last seen exiting her friend's place with a tall guy, about 5'10", dark hair, thick eyebrows. And that matches a lot of descriptions of this person, the thick or bushy eyebrows, and late 20s to mid-30s. And somebody discovers her in her VW Beetle, which seems to be pretty popular, according to this book, of a vehicle at that time. What is her condition? How is she found?
She is found in the vehicle, on her back, her partially clothed, her bottoms removed, and strangled to death in the back of her car. And, of course, her car was in this parking lot. She was found by the aged parking attendant in the morning. But her car had been parked in reverse under a tree, which is interesting because she never reversed her car to park. In fact, she hated doing it. She would always go out of her way to find a parking spot she could pull into because she wasn't any good at reverse parking. So the killer must have been driving her car at some point. And her underwear, there was, of course, semen internally, but also semen on her underwear. So police at the time thought that she'd had consensual sex, then been murdered, and then had her clothing removed. But I don't know about that. Jackie English also, when they found her underwear, they found a semen sample on her underwear as well as the internal samples. So that's a consistency there. Helga's older. She's found in a car and she's found in an urban area. So I understand why people would want to exclude her based on those factors. But at the same time, the partially clothed sexual homicide strangulation on her back, it's very similar. And I do have to admit, as you mentioned, the suspect description is very similar to one of the top suspects in the book. And I wouldn't discount this at all from the list of victims involved.
Mm-hmm. You talk about in October, the reward was offered for information about Jackie English, Jacqueline Dunleavy and Fred Jensen, which for $50,000, so that's a very impressive amount at that time. Then you talk about Linda White and Bruce Stapleton. Linda White's story is very heartbreaking. Tell us about, she decides to move from Burlington to London, Ontario. Tell us a little bit about Linda White and her family.
Yeah, Linda came from a very successful family from Burlington. She was a sweet girl, and they had everything they needed. She had a happy home life, and they had enough money to make themselves happy. She was shy, you know, in high school. But in her senior year, she sort of changed. She bleached her dark brown hair into this blonde, and she started dating the star quarterback. She was an athlete on the track and field team, and she found herself as one of the popular kids. And she was a great student. She was doing really well. She had a very promising future. So a whole bunch of her friends in Burlington graduated high school and all decided to go to Western University. So they moved here, and two of her high school friends were actually her roommates, and they got a little cottage off campus to live together. And, you know, they were having a good time. She'd only been at Western for a couple months. It was November. She was taking a French exam, and she finished her exam, and she wanted to go out and have a drink after class, but she couldn't find anyone to go along with her. So she got a lift, not to her house, but to a neighborhood adjacent to her neighborhood, like a 10-minute walk. And presumably she was going to stop by someone else's house and see if they would go for a drink with her, you know, not wanting to give up on celebrating her successful French exam. But she never made it home. So the last person to see her was the individual who dropped her off, and then she was gone. So her family came from Burlington. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Her family came immediately from Burlington. And in fact, they knew her roommate had called the family, and her brother came right away, John, shortly followed by her father. They knew the police wouldn't pay attention. And in fact, when they did finally call the police just said, oh, she's run away. She's just another hippie, you know. But what's interesting is what prompted them to call the police. They were really worried. I mean, they started their own civilian search for her right away. And they went, just like Jackie's family, went into her room to search for clues. And they didn't see anything out of the ordinary. But, you know, 2 days into the search, they go into her room and they see her clothes that she'd been wearing on the night she disappeared bundled up under her bed.
Right.
And this is new. And, you know, they're asking themselves, did you see that before? And this isn't like Linda. Linda's someone who folds stuff up. She's a neat and tidy girl. So this scared them so much that that's when they called the police.
Now, you write that they were asked, the friends were asked, were those clothes under that bed in the first search? And they said, no, we're certain they weren't. What did the police conclude? Again, not so surprising. What do they say and conclude from that same information?
Oh, she just came home before she went to the bar. She got changed. She threw her stuff under the bed, and she went out drinking.
Yeah. Incredible. Now, you include June 7th, 1969, Bruce Stapleton. He's 11 years old, and his remains aren't found until September 23rd. There's not so much information about him, but do you say there's a possible connection? What is the condition he's found in, and is that part of the possible connection in your mind?
Well, yeah, Bruce was... Yeah, as you said, 11 years old, and he regularly went off on his own to go camping in the woods. So it took a little longer for his family to clue in that he was missing. But he was living with a single father who had been widowed and had his own children and his stepchildren. He had a large brood of kids to take care of. So these children were very self-sufficient. And being raised by a dad, so they're kind of rough and tumble boys. You know, you could kind of picture it as a sitcom, you know. And Bruce goes off to go camping, and his body was found, as you say, that September, farther than an 11-year-old would walk. He's found out on the sort of rural outskirts of northern London, at Sunningdale in Adelaide, which doesn't mean anything to anyone who's not from London, I'm sorry. He was in the woods, and his body was skeletalized and torn apart by animals. So the scene of his body disposal scene is much more difficult to interpret than that of the other victims. I don't know how much clothing he had on. I don't know if there was any semen found at the scene. I do have one tidbit of information that they suspected he was killed by blunt force trauma with a brick. There was also a lead that there was a shed not far from where his body was found that had actually been torn down in between the time he went missing and when his body was found. And the property owner said that when they tore the shed down, part of their motivation for that was that they could tell people had been living in it. So, you know, that's an interesting note as well for that case. But I think in general, when you have an anomalous spate of child murders going on in a place, you include all of them. And, you know, Bruce was clearly taken by someone who was in a vehicle. He's a young boy. He's murdered. And probably by blunt force trauma. So there are enough commonalities that, you know, I wouldn't exclude him. I'd keep him in there, because what are the chances that this is a one-off murder when you have the context of a serial killer, right? You have to include it until you can exclude it, in my opinion.
We have, in your book, you have a particular, it's not a detour, but it's as great true crime and fantastic nonfiction stories, you can't even come up with stuff like this in fiction. There is a Betty Harrison and there's a Glenn Fryer, but we won't have enough time to go down this. It's not a rabbit hole, but it's a very, very complex, interesting case with Betty Harrison. Let's just go and describe this in general, because it ends up in a trial and it ends up in a discharge with the judge making a statement to him, but we don't want to skip over David Bodimer and the Jehovah Witnesses and that incredible story and investigation and trial. So let's summarize somewhat Betty Harrison and Glenn Fryer and their connection and this incredible trial. That's part of just a small part of your book.
Yeah, and I thank you for bringing it up, because I think for those readers who do want to engage with the material on that level, I think the Glenn Fryer trial and investigation is incredibly revealing in regards to the Jackie English murder, and it can't be discounted at all. But it is that sort of complex, puzzle-solving detective work that has to go into it, and putting these sort of intricate pieces together. So it is bizarre. But essentially, Betty Harrison was this woman who came forward as an eyewitness, not an eyewitness, but as a witness for the Jackie English murder. And she said that the night before Jackie disappeared, she saw these two men at the Metropolitan Restaurant talking to Jackie, and that Jackie was upset. And these men, of course, became persons of interest for the police. They made a composite sketch, and it was published widely in the local media. So Betty had come forward as this witness, and she starts getting harassing phone calls, knocks on the door in the middle of the night, threatening letters, and eventually she is attacked. She receives a whole bunch of cuts, 27 lacerations, hospitalized, and eventually she fingers her attacker as Glenn Fryer, who's actually the principal of Children's Psychiatric Research Institute, where Jackie Dunleavy's body was found. So
right.
the London community assumed that whoever had attacked Betty Harrison was also responsible for Jackie English's murder. So the trial that came up about a year later, in November of 1970, really was for the community also a trial for all of these unsolved murders, and Londoners really wanted a resolution. It's a very exciting chapter in the story. Actually, it's a whole chunk of chapters in the story. But essentially, what happens is Glenn Fryer is given a Scottish verdict. So the judge is saying to him, there's not enough for me to find you guilty, but I can't acquit you. You're neither guilty nor innocent. And he pleads with him. And actually, Dan, I talked to one of the reporters who was there, whose articles I used actually as research. I saw him recently at a book event. And he said to me that the judge was verklempt, just desperately saying to him, if you committed these crimes, giving the impression really that he thought he had, but that he didn't have enough evidence to put him behind bars. Just please get help. Please stop, you know? And of course, Glenn Fryer leaves with a huge smile on his face, a much bigger smile than most of us would have, I think, after a judge basically said, you're guilty, but I can't lock you up.
Sure.
He goes out there like he's been completely exonerated with this huge smile on his face with the cameras and kissing his wife and showing off to the press and telling jokes. I mean, he is a character. So I know we're not going to get into him, but to me, he's a major suspect in these murders. I have interviewed him. I've spoken to him, and I would never take him off the table. He's definitely of vital interest. But yes, you're right. That trial and the investigation is very complicated and bizarre. And I think people who like that in true crime are really going to enjoy that section of the book. People who like a more straightforward bad guy caught by, you know, cop, more straightforward thing aren't going to be. But if you like puzzles, that's the best section, I think, of the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, you include the case of, again, a very sad case of Sarera O'Connell. And this is this biracial. She's Pakistani, and her father is Caucasian, I believe. And she goes to, she is in school. She's shy. Her friends are telling her, listen, this is the kind of time where this at this community dance, you need to reach out and approach somebody. It's just a dance. And, of course, she does. Tell us what happens at this dance.
Yeah, she was at this dance, and they had, you know, the switch where the girls asked the boys. And, of course, as I say in the book, she thought she should ask the boys she wanted to dance with, not the boys she could dance with. So she goes to one of the most handsome, popular boys in school and asks him to dance. And he turns around in front of everyone and tells her he would never dance with, you know, I think he said like a fat, smelly immigrant. And she's embarrassed and horrified. And she runs out of the dance. And, of course, this dance is on the edge of town. She doesn't have a ride. The dance is on the northern end of the city this time, in actually an old country schoolhouse that had been shut down. And essentially in a rural area. I grew up right near there, and there was nothing. I mean, it's built up now, but there was nothing. So she walked over towards what's really Highway 4. It's Highbury Ave once it gets into the city, but in this section at that time, it was really a country road, and presumably got in a vehicle. There were some people who said they saw her hitching to get home, and she was never seen alive again.
Let's talk about Georgia Jackson, and tell us where Elmer is in relation to London, and tell us a little bit about her work at the Dairy Bar and who owned the Dairy Bar, and this fascinating introduction of the Jehovah Witness members.
Yeah, before I tell you about Georgia, I want to tell you that when I met Dennis Alsop Jr., and he knew I wanted to look at his dad's files, he brought two file folders with him. And these file folders were next to each other when he went through his dad's boxes. They were the two fattest folders he had on these murders. And one was Jackie English, and the other was Georgia Jackson. So he thought this murder was important, okay? Georgia was a 20-year-old girl, a member of the Jehovah's Witness community in Elmer, Ontario. Now, Elmer is like about a half-hour drive outside of London, heading southeast. It's a small community. It's actually the home of the Ontario Police College. So there's a lot of, you know, cops in training around the area. It was a former World War II RCF training, like a Royal Canadian Air Force training grounds too. So there's always been men in uniform around there. And it's also a community that's surrounded by Mennonites and Amish. So it really comes across as like the safest place in the world because it's all Mennonites and Amish and cops, right?
There's nothing
bad going on. And there was a really thriving Jehovah's Witness community, a community that really appreciated that sort of atmosphere, and Georgia was part of that group. She lived with her parents. She'd never had a boyfriend. She didn't drink. She didn't swear. And she was actually hoping to go into the ministry, as far as women were allowed to, within her faith community. She worked at the dairy bar, which is like the temperance response to bars. So the idea is that it's a bar, but it's milk, you know, so it's okay.
Yeah.
I love that they call it a bar. So she worked there, and actually I believe the owner was Jehovah's Witness as well, and her coworkers were Jehovah's Witness. So she got off work at 6 p.m. on February 18th, 1966. It was stormy. Like, it was a gross winter night. And she actually had called home. She only lived 3 or 4 blocks away, but she called home to see if her mom wanted her to pick anything up. And at first her mom said, oh, yeah, stop and get some butter. But then she's like, it's a crappy night. You know what? I'm just going to get in the car and go to the grocery store. You just come home. And when George's mom came home after grocery shopping, her daughter had never appeared. She wasn't there.
Yeah. Now, with these Jehovah's Witnesses, they know that they don't call police right away to report her missing. What do they do?
Oh, right. Well, they started a search. They organized a search. So, you know, they got everyone together to go out and look, but the storm was terrible, you know. And actually, they did call the police, but it was Chief Henderson. And Chief Henderson, who is just a completely backwards idiot of a person, it's wonderful that you can't be sued for libel if people are dead. This guy was just the worst. And, you know, he ends up getting his own in the book, and I'm very pleased about that. What an idiot. So, of course, they call and tell him, and he's like, no, no big deal. And in fact, one of the members of the Jehovah's Witness community, to get the news to surrounding police forces, had to call their local city council in the middle of the night and wake them up. And then that individual informed the London police and the media about this missing girl, who really, you know, they said, oh, she probably ran away. It's too much pressure from her religious community. She's just another, you know, she's taken off. She's blowing off some steam. But everyone who knew her knows that's not Georgia. She's not going to take off, you know. So they start the search, and then it's too cold. So they all go home to bed, and they start again the next day. Again, no police assistance. So this is February 18th, February 19th. The Jehovah's Witnesses were incredible. They got hundreds of witnesses to come from all around the province. They even had someone lend them a helicopter. They, you know, had dogs out. They were doing all the work to find Georgia, and no police involvement at all. In fact, the police still didn't get involved when Georgia's mom got this phone call. There's a phone call to the Jackson house, and Georgia's mom speaks to someone she believes is her daughter, who says, I'm being held by two men, right?
Yeah.
So she immediately calls police and says, Georgia's alive. She's being held by two men, she told me. Police say, oh, it's just a crank call. That's 3 days after she's taken, okay? There's no official law enforcement involvement in this case until March 5th. So you're talking about 2 weeks of complete inactivity.
Yeah, incredible. You even write, too, the mayor called to offer a $500 reward, and the chief said it would be a waste of money.
Yeah.
So he gets his.
And when
anyway.
They finally... Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No. When you're talking, too, that her body is found February 27th. Some boys are just scavenging on the side of the road. And you talk about that, or what they found, not her body, pardon me, her coat. And it was blood and semen on it. And that's when the OPP got involved. And what happens to Chief Henderson as a result?
Oh, he got in huge trouble. And I mean, even more so once her body was found. They immediately asked for an inquiry. He lost his job. He ended up becoming an ambulance dispatcher in Sudbury. And anyone who's from Canada can tell you that being forced to move to Sudbury is a punishment. sorry to my Sudbury friends. I'm sure you love your town and your city, but to the rest of us, that doesn't sound great.
It's cold up there. Sure.
And it's small. Yeah. So he was completely demoted. I do understand, actually, I didn't get to include it in the book because I found out after it came out, but he was also a bootlegger, this Chief Henderson. So he was just all around a charming individual.
Right. Now, for those people that might be a little bit confused, your book, you do start in 1969 and then Detective Alsup, and then you go backwards. And when we mentioned that Detective Alsup said, I remember a case from a couple years earlier, we were talking about this 1966 case, and because of this, the OPP had taken over the case from Chief Henderson and the London police. So they, because of his forensic training, he was involved. Now, tell us about Albert Crooker, who's an elder in the Jehovah Witnesses, and who has a son-in-law named David Bodimer. When they are searching for Georgia, how is he involved? And tell us what witnesses say about David Bodimer at that time.
Oh, at that time, I think, well, first of all, Albert Crooker is like the head pastor of the local Jehovah's Witnesses in Elmer. So there, it's called an overseer, which really just makes me think of Fallout, the video game. So he's the overseer, and his daughter Elaine is married to David Bodimer. So it's his son-in-law. And David works for his father-in-law sometimes. His father has like a business. His father-in-law has a business cleaning after hours. So the story that David gave, which, I mean, I won't get into it. I don't necessarily believe the story, but the story that David gave was that, they were working at the bank that night, cleaning the bank, and Georgia Jackson's brother-in-law, Dennis Sullivan, came by and told them that Georgia was missing, and they left the bank and went to go look for her in the snow. But David Bodimer didn't have a coat on, which he later said he didn't have that coat on because it had Georgia's blood on it, and he had hidden the coat. So he's out looking for her in the snow with no coat on, so they tell him to go home, because it's winter and you can't be out here with no coat. But he later participated in searches for her body, and he was at her funeral. And Albert Crooker, his father-in-law, performed her funeral service.
Mm-hmm. Now, how is it that what Crooker does David know and the elders, including Albert, suspect? Give us how that works, in that they suspect that somebody knows more information about David, and what do they do as a result?
Well, David was a problem, right, for Albert and his daughter, Elaine. And actually, after George's murder in 1966, which, we didn't talk about the crime scene there, but they did find her body, and they never could solve a case. And after 1966, in fact, less than a year after that murder, David moved his family with his wife away from Elmer. And he had escalating issues with police. So he would get caught with petty theft, public nudity, exposure, lewd acts, pornography, exhibitionism. So he had escalating interactions with police, getting caught with sexually related crimes. And of course, as we know, petty theft or voyeurism, peeping Tom stuff is often part of a developing issue for sex offenders.
Right.
Like Paul Bernardo was peeping Tom for years before he started raping. So, David's family, who were very conservative religious people, were really disappointed in him. He wasn't becoming a church elder. I mean, his dad's a head pastor. I mean, his father-in-law is a head pastor. His parents are part of the Jehovah's Witness community too. They lived in Alliston, Ontario. everyone's really disappointed in David every time he gets arrested for these truly embarrassing crimes. And, you know, he's someone who they're looking at. And there are all these rumors going on in the church that someone from in the church killed Georgia, you know? So It kept building and building and building. And eventually, 6 years after her murder, the gossip had just kept going on, and it was not going away. The Jehovah's Witness Church actually got to the higher-ups in the national organization to go to Elmer and talk to the congregation and try to get to the bottom of it.
Now, they realize David Bodimer's in Kitchener, so they go to Kitchener. What happens when they bang on his door? What happens when they broach the subject of George's death?
Yeah, Kitchener's about an hour, more like 45 minutes away from Elmer. So they go to his house there where he's living. You know, he works in blue-collar jobs. He worked at a concrete factory. He worked for the rail yard, you know, these kinds of jobs. And they knocked on his door on a Friday. And he sort of knew he'd been caught. And he said to them, you know, just give me the weekend to talk to my wife. And he put it off all weekend. It was Sunday night. He was lying in bed with Elaine. And he just went into emotional hysterics. And he told her that he had killed Georgia Jackson 6 years earlier. So Elaine called her father, who I think already knew. And the next day, Albert Crooker and these two up-and-ups from the Jehovah's Witness Church drove to Kitchener. And this is really interesting. The first confession that David gave for this murder, the first statement he gives, is a written-out confession that he gave to the Jehovah's Witnesses that they had him sign before they called the police.
Mm-hmm.
So they called the OPP, and Detective Alsop went himself, actually, to arrest David and took him to OPP headquarters where his office was and interrogated him and then got a second confession from him as well.
Now, with Alsop's second confession and the first one that he reviewed, what information did he get? And we talked about, and we haven't talked so much about, you know, this guy that would never give up, but we put in the introduction that he was continuing to investigate till he died, you know, 40 years after this. So this guy was not let this thing go. So when he interviewed Bodimer, what information did he have, and how much did he believe he had this perpetrator, not only of Gloria Jackson, but of other victims as well?
Yeah, I mean, this is, if you keep in mind that in the 6 years since Georgia Jackson's been murdered, there have been all these other murders. And the whole time, Detective Alsop is looking back at Georgia Jackson's murder saying, this all seems like the same person. And can I tell you, with Jackie English, when they found her clothes were scattered along the highway and her shoes were found next to a pond in a lover's lane, like in a quarry, up the road from where Georgia Jackson's body was found. Mm-hmm. So again, there's this geography that's so similar. And, you know, Alsop had his antennas pointed firmly up. He was looking at this guy for all of these murders. So, you know, he interviews him and he is looking for any slip up. There was a moment in the interview where David used the pronoun we. He says, we
right.
went here. And Detective Alsop catches him on it. Who's we? You know, he's really paying attention to those details. But at the same time, too, he's working within a system. And I think it became a priority for him to have Bodimer convicted because Bodimer did not confess to any other murders, you know, any murders that he may have allegedly committed. And Alsop wanted to get him off the street because clearly whoever was doing this to young women and children in the London area was not going to stop.
You write, too, that the idea that Bodimer was involved, Bodimer had told him some details about an outbuilding where he had stashed some stuff. So what does Alsop do? You said they just wanted a conviction for this one murder. But regardless of that, What does Alsip do?
Well, the first thing he does is he wants to track down the car. So David tells them essentially that he picked up Georgia without planning on killing her, that he hit her over the back of the head with a Coke bottle from the back of the back seat of the car spontaneously, then drove out to a country road with her sort of coming in and out of consciousness on his shoulder, bleeding all over his winter coat and all over the car seat. And then he took her out into, you know, a quiet country road, and she decided to have sex with her, and she was screaming. So he put his hand over her mouth and accidentally suffocated her while he was raping her. This was the story he told police. So then he said that he went back to his house, which had a garage attached to it, which incidentally, he continued to, not incidentally, but as a piece of information, he continued to rent that garage after his family moved away. He rented that garage until 1972 or 71 when it was torn down. So he had stashed Georgia's gloves and her bloody jacket and his bloody jacket in the walls of that garage. So the first thing Detective Alsop does is he tracks down this car because there should be blood in the car. And that's a feat on its own. The car had been sold almost immediately in 1966 and had been gone around secondhand, you know, and had ended up in a junkyard. So they had to dig this car out of the snow. And they did indeed find George's blood in the car. So that's a pretty incredible piece of detective work there, because that's on the ground. There's no computer tracking system for ownership. He's got to go to each owner and ask, what did you do with this car? You know, he's driving around all over southwestern Ontario. And then he wants to confirm that this bloody coat and George's gloves are in this garage. So he goes to where the garage was, and it's been torn down recently, like within the last 6 months. So he talks to the property owner and he finds out where they disposed of the garage. And it, you know, they had put it in a farmer's field in Dorchester, right, Ontario. So Alsop is so dogged that he takes a shovel, and in March, I think it's March 17th, oh, St. Patrick's Day, I just realized that, or it might have been the 21st, goes out to this field with the frozen dirt, and he digs, and he himself finds George's glove in the debris from that garage. So now he has physical evidence that matches the confession to convict David Bottomer of murdering Georgia Jackson. And to me, that's just incredible detective work. I'm very impressed by that.
You write, too, later, Elaine, Bottomer's wife, said to Alsop, unprompted, and mentioned Jackie English, just reinforcing his idea that there was always a connection. That must have struck him as incredible.
Yeah, for readers who want to put it together, that story is crucial. You need to pay attention to the relationships between these individuals. Elaine said that she and her husband were in London a couple of days before Jackie English went missing, and she saw them. They saw her having lunch with, in excuse the vernacular, a colored man at a diner in London. And in fact, Jackie had lunch with Bill Grote, a person of color that she went to school with. And she had told her boyfriend about it. I think she wrote about it in her diary as well. So, you know, that was confirmed. That actually happened. But I have to ask myself, you know, if I go to dinner and then someone who was having dinner in that same restaurant or even a small restaurant, you know, with 10 tables, went missing and was murdered shortly thereafter, I wouldn't remember them. Like, you don't pay that much close attention to people around you in a restaurant that you would remember.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? It leads me to think that they must have interacted somehow. Or how would she have known that was her?
Yeah, very interesting. You write, June 27th, 1972, despite the confessions, he pleads not guilty. It's not capital murder in Canada. They hadn't had an execution since 62. In this particular case, it's not a capital murder case. Tell us a little bit about the trial itself, any incredible features of that trial.
Well, first of all, that he pled not guilty after giving two confessions and there's physical evidence to back up his confessions is just absurd. So his lawyer had first tried to get him an NCR ruling, which is not criminally responsible. So he sent him for psychiatric testing. And of course that failed. And maybe he didn't want to go to the psych hospital was particularly unpleasant in 1972.
Sure.
So, I'd rather go to jail, frankly. They had this idea that, there was some sort of religious pressure that created a false confession. But, of course, the physical evidence backed up the confession. And, Alsop and his team made sure that they had witnesses on the stand that would back up that confession. Now, I don't know if everything in the confession is accurate. I don't think it is. But I think the focus was on getting a conviction. I found it really astounding. They took the rape charge off. Because they said they couldn't prove that the sex that he had with Georgia Jackson wasn't consensual, which is just ridiculous to me. Because, mm-hmm. after I have consensual sex, I always get raped and murdered.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some pretty horrifying misogyny in the text for the trial. But that aside, the community really came together and what was really astounding, he's convicted, but even before his conviction, which I think they were pretty sure they were going to get a conviction, and he got a life sentence, which in Canada at the time meant 25 to life, and I'll follow up on that with you in a minute. In London, at the same time this trial was going on, the chief of police recommended to city council that they rescind the $50,000 reward they had put out for Jackie English, for Jackie Dunleavy and Frankie Jensen's murders. So police didn't think that reward needed to be on the table anymore.
Incredible.
And that was finalized during David Bottomer's trial.
Yeah. You write that Alsop was heavily involved in the Linda White investigation, but that was the last homicide he worked in London area. He moved to Toronto with a new job superintendent. And then you write, too, that basically this man that was dedicated to his job once upon a time worked 80 hours a week and took the file boxes home and took the cases home with him and kept them in his heart and in his mind. Now he just concentrated on his family. He was married 66 years and had a great family life after that, but never forgot about this, kept those files, and then faithfully his son walked into your bookstore and you had developed a relationship and the product was this incredible book, The Forest City Killer. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about The Forest City Killer, a serial murderer, a cold case sleuth, and a search for justice. For people that want to take a look at more information or find out about this book, is there a Facebook page, website that they might take a look at?
Yeah, they can go to forestcitykiller.com. I've got some extra material there that wasn't in the book. And since the Unsolved Canada website went down, I actually have archived the Jackie English forum thread, which was like 61 pages or something absurd like that. So there are extra photos and things that didn't make it into the book. So forestcitykiller.com. And people can email me at info@forestcitykiller.com if they want to chat or if they have any tips or questions. I'm always happy to talk to people about the case.
It's been a remarkable time spent with you talking about The Forest City Killer, an incredible, remarkable book. Thank you very much, Vanessa Brown.
Thank you.
You have a great night.
You
Good
too.
Night.